This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking. Good day to you. It is Wednesday, the 19th of March. I'm Alec Hogg. And in our top story tonight, we've got a cut for you from a fascinating interview with Dr. Franz Cronier. When I spoke to him 2 weeks ago, more than 320,000 people as of today had watched that discussion. I'm pretty sure that there's going to be a lot of interest in today's discussion as well. There have been a lot of loud voices urging the Democratic Alliance to buckle and endorse the ANC's VAT increase proposals. Dr. Cronier disagrees, and here's the part of our interview today where he explains why.
You don't need the government of national unity at all costs. There's no point in having a government of national unity that essentially maintains the policies it inherited and the rate of economic growth. You can't be a 1% growth country with a 30% youth unemployment rate and think that by sitting tight, it's all going to be okay. I assure you, it will not be okay in the fullness of time. And in the fullness of time, probably sooner than people realize, the reasons that caused ANC support to collapse, the inability to meet the material circumstances, expectations of people, that will attach the GNU and it will pull the GNU down as well. And when you pull the GNU down, you don't know what you get in the aftermath. You could get something radical and populist. So it's absolutely wrong to say the you stand on the GNU at all costs because it's, otherwise we'd have doomsday, whatever that was. No, you don't do that. The GNU has to be a catalyst for reform. And I think the DA and John Steenhuisen specifically did very well during those talks. We spoke about that at the time to get, and I think a great, and the ANC people as well, getting South Africa to the GNU at that moment was a great achievement, and we should be grateful to everyone involved. Of late, since the budget, I think the DA has played things very well. They're in a strong position. You know, ANC voters disapprove or oppose tax increases by a margin of 2-3 to 1. So what the ANC has done to get itself in a position where it's clinging to what we call a VAT baby and fighting the DA to the point of threatening the survival of the GNU, which is very popular still with the public, the GNU, because they also fear this doomsday kind of idea. How it's positioned itself like that is one of these, like I said, I don't know. I don't know how you get into a position where you're at 40% of the vote and at your next budget, you champion increasing taxes on the poor. And then you fight that to the very death. It's unbelievable. So you can make a tax argument on this, but more important for the DA is it's resetting the balance of power inside the GNU here and the terms of reference, that it actually is a coalition between two parties in the map. So it's also a GNU, but it's actually a coalition between two parties. And if the DA does not manage to establish such a new balance of power, then there is no prospect that the GNU could introduce the kinds of reforms to improve South Africa's economic performance by raising, again, the one thing, fixed investment to GDP. And I think they've thus far played this thing pretty well. They have sympathy in the ANC, I assure you of that. There are people who have made calls to senior ANC leaders and said, what are you doing on this VAT increase? There are so many other means to get to the same position, and to threaten the GNU is not in your best interests.
Well, there you have it from South Africa's top political scientist. On to the BizNews conference last week, and as mentioned earlier in the week, we are republishing two of the keynotes per day. And today, the first of those was Gayton McKenzie, the Minister of Sport and leader of the Patriotic Alliance. He was a great hit. He has a wonderful sense of humor, lots of charisma, and not surprisingly that people love to listen to Gayton. He was sharing stories and brought his unique sense of humor to proceedings. His message, however, was deadly serious. He believes, different to Dr. Cronier, that South Africa cannot afford the government of national unity to collapse. He explained this in graphic detail, and let's listen now to a clip from the PA leader's address. Remember, the full discussion, the full hour of Gayton is on BizNews TV on YouTube.
The most popular man in South Africa is Jacob Zuma. Don't ask me, I know your mind can't comprehend it. He's the most popular man in South Africa. He came out of jail and within 4 months he built a party that's the third largest party in South Africa. Do you know what? This is a man for 10 years that has had negative newspapers every day. If I think Cyril Ramaphosa is the strongest member in the ANC, if there was no Cyril Ramaphosa, Zuma would have already finished the ANC, I can promise you. Because the ANC always had unionists, people that come from jail, people that were in exile. That is part of the currency. And that currency is now disappearing. The leaders that are coming in don't come from exile. Are not trade unionists like Cyril Ramaphosa and them. Are not Roman Islanders like most of the leadership. So somebody asked me, do you think you can stop Jacob Zuma? At the moment, I know I can't stop him. Do you think the ANC can stop him? Hell no, they can't stop him. Can the DA stop him? Nobody can stop him. There's only one thing that can stop Jacob Zuma. Never forget what I'm going to tell you today. If you don't stop Jacob Zuma, he is going to lead this country in 2029. He's strong on his way, whether you like that or not. And Zuma's unapologetic of what he's going to do when he comes in. Expropriation without compensation is number one on his list. And that will destroy property rights. And any country with no property rights is not a country. What will stop Jacob Zuma? The GNU. The GNU will stop Jacob Zuma, and that's the only thing that the DA and the PA needs to understand, and the ANC. Only the GNU can stop Jacob Zuma. We can't lose the GNU because of 0.5% vet. We can't. It can't happen. It shouldn't happen. We need the DA. I never thought I'd say this in my life. You know, I was in watching Twickenham. I was in Twickenham watching the Springboks and meeting, understanding this Ekele deal when I was in London. And I got a call from our government saying, can you please not come back tonight? Can you meet 12 billionaires, South African billionaires, tomorrow for lunch? They specifically want to speak to you. And I met them. And when I met them for lunch, I looked at them and they said to me, thank you for coming. We have one question to ask you. I said, I'll only answer that question on one condition. They said, what's the condition? I said that I can ask you a question at the end of the, after answering your question. They said, fine. They said, is the GNU going to last? I said, any other question? They said, no. We want to leave London. We want to take our money back into South Africa. London is becoming impossible, but we want you to answer that question. I said, the GNU is going to last for one reason. I said, yes, it's going to last. They say, what's your reason? I said, I don't even think we like each other in the GNU. I don't really like the DA. They definitely hate me. We don't really like each other, but we sure as hell despise the guys that are on the outside. None of us would open the door for Malema and for Zuma to enter. And there's no greater motivation for us to tolerate each other, because non-tolerance of each other means that door is wide open for the people that we don't want in the GNU.
Well, you can get that full recording, as you can the full recording of Discovery founder Adrian Gore's address to the BizNews conference. One of the highlights, I felt, he made a compelling case for why it's worth fighting for South Africa. As you might expect from this actuary and entrepreneurial genius, he used data as well and provided a rational perspective for fretting South Africans. It's a real treat. And as a taster, here's Adrian's take on national health insurance, whose implementation is one of the biggest concerns for many taxpayers.
Directionally, I still feel confident about finding a middle line. About a month ago, you remember there was a potential deal around the private sector. But the issue here is when you look at the numbers, especially the NHI, it's not a piece of oil you can switch on. You need the funding, you know. So to an extent, there's unless you are intent on destroying the country, you cannot implement it. You know, you could say tomorrow we kill off the private healthcare system, you destroy every business. I think, you know, this is much bigger than private healthcare. This is about the economy. So I think that there's a rational engagement. I do think that in the people that really are in the know, even in the Department of Health, which is feels very strongly about this, there's an acceptance that this is a long-term process. And I think in the minister's affidavit in one of the court cases has made the point that this is a 10, 15-year process. So my sense is that in the case of NHI, the kind of reality about the funding overrides ideology on whatever side you're on of this issue, and we have to find a rational way. The only scenario I can see of like a blunt NHI that's destructive is someone who's moving to destroy the country. You know, and then I think this is a sovereign issue. This is not about healthcare. This is a much bigger issue. And even then, you don't have money. You don't have the cash for it. So that's the point. You know? I mean, what's lost in this, I just want to say, is just people don't understand the quality of that system. Forget about us as a fund. I'm saying the quality of hospitals and doctors and access. And go to the UK and try the NHS and see what it's like. Yeah. And just again, loss aversion. Understand what we have to lose, you know.
Yeah, well, the medical tourism is certainly pretty reaffirming that whole issue. How important is the government of national unity from where you're sitting?
I think it's very important. Ironically, I think losing it is more scarier than getting it. It's more scary than the goodness of getting it. I think losing it, the symbolism of losing it, is not good. But if it wasn't here in the first place, I think that we'd muddle on because there's some resilience, you know, and hopefully that, you know, as a private sector we can do a lot. But I think it's very important. And I think as you're saying, the minister previously and other speakers, the alternatives are problematic. And that's why I worry about the extremes. You know, if you're in a rational environment with many actors with different policies and different ideas, and I'm going to try stuff, and you're relying on an election that brings out rational stuff, but you're not. I think in most societies, when they're really under threat, as you can see from the data, you get that survivalist mindset and you lose the center. And the one thing about the previous election, the GNU, 75% of the electorate voted in the center, you know, didn't vote for the extremes. That's a massive asset. We should never forget that. So I'm ignoring policies and the detail about the GNU. I think the GNU represents the middle I'm speaking about. So if you've been holding the middle, you've got to hold that GNU. I think every time we hear about a debate in government that it's going to fall apart, I know they have to flex their muscles all over. It's the greatest thing. It could be a fantastic illustration of how GNU should work, this VAT issue. But I don't think we should see ultimatums, you know, as South Africans all the time. Will it, won't it, will it? I hope it holds. We need it. The alternative is worse.
In the world of business banking, projections, numbers, and your bottom line can often triumph over relationships. At Investec, we value both. That's why we understand that running a successful business takes endurance, drive, and partners who are willing to walk the journey with you. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking. Out of the ordinary.
At SunExchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.
Well, the standing ovation for Neil de Beer prompted me to get hold of the man who wrote you could call it a combined autobiography about Neil and himself. His name is Bradley Stain. We had a fascinating conversation this morning, and he told me a lot about Neil and a lot about his book as well. But one of the things that's going wrong at the moment is that Neil de Beer has been courted by a number of political parties. So I asked Bradley, whose book, by the way, is called Undercover with Mandela's Spies, which political party would be the most natural home for this rising superstar of South African politics, Mr. De Beer?
Neil will want to make sure that, you know, we all have a place in under the sun here in South Africa. And that means, you know, getting rid of this cancel culture, canceling the white, canceling the Boer, you know, all this nonsense that we are supposed to be embarrassed about, our komfandan, our heritage. You know, he would also, you know, vehemently take on corruption, and we would help with that as well, us that are in the background, you know, making sure that he could achieve what he would want to achieve. But if Mozilla or Mr. Steenhuis would come to Neil, you know, it would have to take a lot, because Neil would have to be given the opportunity where he truly can affect legislative change, so that he can improve the lives of people. But Neil would be fantastic in a national security law enforcement cluster, SEPs, something like that. But he's you're right. His leadership abilities are remarkable. So yeah. I can't obviously speak for him on what decision he would make, but you know, me personally, I'm a fan of Gait and McKenzie, and I think those two would make a phenomenal team. But I'm also just glad that the GNU is in play. I just and funnily enough, a lot of people don't know that Neil, it was the multi-party charter before it became the GNU. Neil was an intricate part of sitting on a rotating chairmanship around that and helped structure a lot of that. So, you know, if people just dismiss him or you know, don't think that he is a fit within their organization, that it's their loss. And I encourage him to continue with what he's doing with the UIM.
It's really a terrific interview. Very, very unusual. Bradley was, as a young boy, a 17-year-old, he was an eyewitness. He was right there and, in fact, got very close to Baron Strydom, the... Wit Wolf, as he called himself, who executed defenseless black people simply because they were black at Strydom Square, same name, yeah. And had it not been for a man who restrained Bradley, he might well have been one of the victims too. That man who restrained him, and it's all in his book, it's an incredible book, was also executed by Strydom. Anyway. On to matters of global importance, and Colonel Chris Wyatt, who's rather outspoken, he's a retired intelligence operative for the United States, believes that the fractious relationship between South Africa and the USA can be restored, it can be fixed. He spoke to my colleague Chris Stain on exactly how that could happen. This clip is from the interview, which is published on biznews.com on YouTube.
You know, it's interesting to see the complaints. We are in Parliament. Joyce Malema chairs this on the floor. Well, you know, the Americans have done this, and they've insulted us, and they've been aggressive towards us. And all we did was cancel foreign aid to the whole world. And South Africa acted like they were the only ones it happened to and kept insulting Trump. And this is what happens. You know, Trump has been incredibly reserved. Let's put this in play for a second. What has happened? Well, the United States has not kicked South Africa out of the African Growth and Opportunity Act, a duty-free access to our marketplace, which gives us no reciprocity. We don't get the same advantage. We give it to you. And we have not kicked you out. You're not even legally in it, because South Africa passed the Expropriation Without Compensation Act, which abrogates private property rights. And that's a key tenet of our public law. Legally, Trump has no choice but to kick you out of AGOA. And he hasn't done it. He hasn't done. Has he imposed? He's put tariffs on everybody. On Denmark, he threatened it. He put it on Canada. He put it on Mexico. He's put it on European allies because of their treatment of us tariff-wise. South Africa doesn't give the same treatment, and we haven't applied tariffs to South Africa. He's been incredibly reserved when it comes to South Africa, and his reward, constant bombardment, being called the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan by the EFF, who can't even spell Ku Klux Klan. You know, it's just it's beyond the pale. I would recommend that some of these people keep running their mouths in South Africa, just shut up, cease and desist. Otherwise, you're going to get exactly what you want, which begs the question, do these politicians want South Africa to be sanctioned, to be tariffed, to be in such a poor state of relations with the United States? One begins to wonder if that's the plan, because, I mean, either that or we're dealing with the dumbest box of rocks on the planet. People have no understanding. We have members of your government constantly lying about things. Ronnie Lamola going on Deutsche Welle, telling people that every country in the world has expropriation without compensation. Our Fifth Amendment to the Constitution expressly forbids expropriating property without just compensation. You know, it's not helpful. We need adults in the room. I spoke last week with General Bantu Holomisa, and we talked about this. And both of us said, hey, we both agree that adults need to be in the room on both sides. Get in a room, get around the table, and work this out. Talk your differences out, because it's no good. Frankly, it doesn't do much harm to the U.S., but it certainly harms South Africans. And what happens less than 24 hours after our conversation, both of us think, hey, we made progress. If we could talk like this, maybe the government of South Africa can do the same with Washington. And Ibrahim Rasool does what he did, and it's just, it never ends. But it's not over. It can be fixed, but we need people to start behaving.
Let's close off the show with some international news headlines, starting with the phone call between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. They spoke for 2 hours on the ending of the war with Ukraine, but something seems to have got lost in translation.
Russia's Vladimir Putin has refused President Trump's request for a 30-day Ukraine ceasefire during a phone call on ending the conflict, as the two sides offered seemingly conflicting accounts of their discussion. The Kremlin says Putin agreed only to decrease attacks on Ukraine's energy infrastructure while imposing several conditions for a lasting ceasefire, including suspending US arms and intelligence support for Ukraine. However, the White House readout says Trump and Putin agreed to an energy and infrastructure ceasefire. Speaking to Fox News' Laura Ingraham after the call, Trump denied that Putin demanded an end to Western military aid for Ukraine.
Great call. It lasted almost 2 hours. Talked about a lot of things and toward getting it to peace. And we talked about other things also.
Was there non-negotiables mentioned by Putin? It was reported that I think the Kremlin media actually stated that he demanded an immediate cessation of aid to Ukraine in order to get to this multi-step deal.
No, he didn't. We didn't talk about aid, actually. We didn't talk about aid at all. We talked about a lot of things, but aid was never discussed.
Although Ukraine was the focus of the call initiated by Trump, a White House statement also said the two leaders discussed improving bilateral ties, including, quote, enormous economic deals and geopolitical stability when peace has been achieved.
That's from our partners at Bloomberg. Also from Bloomberg, and good news for South Africa is that our troops in the DRC are coming home, and ceasefire commitments have been made between the DRC and Rwanda, pushed along by sanctions on individuals and companies. Here's the Bloomberg report.
And so the significance of this is that it comes off as if Rwanda is committed to finding a lasting solution to the conflict in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo. And it also comes against the backdrop of collapsed talks between M23 and DRC that was supposed to happen in Angola. And this came after the European Union imposed sanctions on senior officials of M23. And in reacting to these sanctions, M23 said they are not in good faith and could jeopardize the dialogue and progress that could have been made in Angola. We are also seeing the sanctions stretch through Rwanda. Top-ranking military officials have been sanctioned. The CEO of Rwanda Mining Board and also Gasabo Gold Refinery on grounds of trafficking of illegal minerals from DRC into Rwanda before they're laundered into the global ecosystem. And pressure is beginning to mount into the region. More than 1 million people displaced. Thousands are dead. And this is beginning to raise diplomatic temperatures in the region.
It's an interesting point that once sanctions on individuals seem to be applied, suddenly politicians realize that they're on the hook personally. I had an experience of this in a board that I once sat on, where there was a lot of obstructive behavior by certain members of the board. And our legal counsel said to them, that's fine, carry on, but I will sue each one of you in your personal capacity. Hey, presto, they started becoming reasonable again. And it appears that's what's happened in that instance. There are many in the United States who are saying we should be applying similar processes to South African politicians. Let's see. And we close off today's Biz News briefing with news from the Middle East, where Israel launched an airstrike on the Gaza Strip, breaking the recent ceasefire. Here's why.
Clearly, this period of relative calm has subsided quite a bit. What is Israel trying to achieve here?
Well, I think Israel regrets, to judge from Netanyahu's comments last night, the fact that 2.5 weeks passed in a kind of limbo. The last ceasefire with Hamas expired in that time period. Israel did not resume warfare, neither did Hamas, but there was no progress in hostage talks. There are 59 hostages remaining in the Gaza Strip, which Israel is intent on recovering. So far, it's tried to do it through a combination of negotiations and warfare. And what Netanyahu is saying is now Israel will resume the warfare, albeit in a staggered fashion. For now, Israel is restraining itself to airstrikes, albeit with a good deal of damage and casualties in the Gaza Strip, while pressuring Hamas to return to negotiations on terms more agreeable to Israel. So it would not appear right now that Israel is an intent on a full resumption of the war to the point where Hamas might be crushed militarily or Israeli troops sweep through the Gaza Strip again. But it's in that direction while leaving the door open for Hamas to come back to the negotiating table with different terms.
Well, you fully caught up now. Look forward to the next episode of the Biz News Briefing tomorrow with Bronwyn Nielsen. Till then, cheerio. This Biz News Briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to private banking service now for your business.